Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Is hair a material?
Are biscuits a material?
Are crystals a material?
Is plastic a material?
Is porridge a material?
Can gases be a material?
Are eggs a material?
Is water a material?
What do you call everything that isn't a material?
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh at your question.
And yet you continue to do so.
Hello and welcome to Handmade, the making podcast with real talk about materials. I'm your host, material scientist Anna Pajewski, and this episode I talked to conservator and podcaster Chloe Rumsey about adhesives. Chloe works as an objects conservator at the People's Museum in Manchester, and she kicked things off by explaining to me what the work of an objects conservator actually entails.
When I say objects conservator, that means that I'm trained in the conservation of lots of different object types, meaning lots of different material types. So that means wood, ceramics, metal, textiles of all different fiber types, and you know, the list goes on essentially. There are different specialisms in conservation, so you do get people who are specialists in textiles or paintings or metals or you know, whatever. But I'm a generalist, so that means that I can do this in theory, do everything, but of course I've got my favourites and I've got the things that I like best and stuff that I would need to ask questions about if I was faced with it.
Yeah. What are your favourites out of interest?
I am specialising in textiles.
Cool.
But it's mostly organics is the stuff that I really, really like. So I love painted wood. I love, which sounds really strange to say, I love paper conservation. I love plant material as well. I've done quite a lot of that in the past. Not so much now, but dry organic stuff.
Amazing.
Is my bag.
How did you get into conservation?
Well, I started off doing a couple of degrees in archaeology, and I started off as a scientist really in A level, but then sort of switched my mindset because I realized that while I have the interest, I don't necessarily have the memory for a lot of the science stuff, and I wanted to focus on sort of history and art and that sort of side a little bit more. So I did a couple of degrees in archaeology, and thinking that I would, you know, innocently thinking that I would go and do a PhD and be an academic, and then the sort of real world hit me and I realized that what that meant was sitting in front of a computer screen all the time and every so often going and digging in a muddy field and you know, usually with no hope of funding or anything like that. So I sort of reassessed and chose conservation as a sort of adjacent use of all of my different interests and skills.
Yeah, very cool. So Did you study that officially or get into it kind of through the job?
Officially. So at the moment, though, we have as a profession some, we're working on issues of how this affects diversity in the sector. You can only really get into it through a conservation degree. And there are different areas of the country that you can do that. You can do it in. I studied in Cardiff University, which has a really famous objects conservation course. There's also UCL, there's Durham, there's Lincoln, Glasgow, and others for the specialisms. So desperately try and remember.
Yeah, no worries. But I guess, yeah, as you say, like perhaps a bit of an elitist route in, or certainly limits to some. people.
There's a lot of... the fact that it's just for degree is just the start, really. Mm. We're trying to argue for, you know, introductions of apprenticeships and things. So there's a bit more, you know, help at the start of there. But, you know, it's quite a difficult thing to get into in general because museums haven't got any funding anymore. So that's a bit of a sort of struggle, I think, for everyone. And it hits the diversity thing, unfortunately.
Yeah, for sure. So the material that we're going to be talking about, you just said that you were a complete material generalist and you're used to working with all sorts of different objects and materials. But we've chosen to narrow that down today to discuss one family of materials, which we've loosely called adhesives, or sort of glues, really. How do you work with glues and adhesives in your work?
Well, it varies a lot, which is why it's such an interesting topic. And they can be made out of so many different materials as well. And I think I thought of this topic because when you were a guest on my podcast, the C Word Conservation Podcast, adhesives was the thing that jumped to mind immediately because we can use so many different types of methods, from cleaning to the physical fixing of museum and heritage objects. But glues and adhesives are, you know, they hold stuff together essentially. So they can be used to either stick two halves of a broken thing together. They can be used to line support textiles to make something stronger, support textiles or support papers. They can also be used at very low concentrations to impregnate into really friable material. So if you've got a piece of stone, for example, that's falling to bits, or ceramic, or wood or anything like that, that would be called consolidation.
Oh, that's so interesting. So I know that there's no one typical object that you tend to work with, but can you give an example of maybe taking us through the process of a conservation piece of work on an object that you've worked on?
Yeah, so I think what a word that I should have said already as a way of describing how we use adhesives is stabilization.
Okay.
Conservation and stabilization, that it's the purpose of the adhesive is to be there to add strength, but not, hopefully, or to the best of our ability, change the appearance of the object. So that is as a comparison to, say, a restoration approach, which would be using things like in painting and covers and stuff to change the physical appearance of the object. There are all sorts of conservation ethics arguments why this might be necessary or desirable, but that sort of strays away from adhesives slightly. So the object that I've got in mind is a multi-stage use of the same kind of adhesive. So that's why I thought it'd be interesting to talk about. So it was a painted textile, and in my job in the People's History Museum, we have so many painted textiles. That's one of the trade union political banners is one of the things that we're really famous for. And this was a really gorgeous little cooperative banner, cooperative Women's Guild banner from 1908. And the painted side of it was sort of tatty and torn at the bottom. It was quite fragile silk, and the painted motif and lettering on it was flaking off, essentially. It was flaking off down to the sort of white primer layer that filled the weave structure at the top. So the adhesive I used was Lascaux, which I would like to ask your sort of for your material science description of that after this, if that's all right,
because sure,
I have some thoughts on the way that conservators think about materials versus the way that material scientists, because we are material scientists, but we use it in a very different sort of artistic way. So this material, Lascaux, comes in two different molecular lengths, is a 498 as a sort of buzzword there, and 303. We tend to use this as a mix because it uses the different properties of the molecular lengths. So it makes it both strong and a bit sticky, basically. Mm. So the two different ways I was using them, the first way I was using it dry, which is really interesting and a method that I only really started using whilst I was specializing in textiles conservation. And the method is to use a very thin piece of textile. So we call it silk crepoline. It's very, very thin, thinner than a chiffon, quite floaty and difficult to work with. If it's got any sort of creases or crumples in it at all, cause it's that thin. I dyed that to match the textile. I needed to apply that to the reverse so that it would support the fragile textile and then allow me to sort of stick together all of the torn edges. Because it was, imagine, really frayed, really sort of stringy silk that's just totally shattered along paint lines and things. I should say, actually, though some textiles can be stitched, if it's painted, it's not appropriate to be stitched because you'd just be poking holes in the paint all over the place.
Right.
And that's where the sort of adhesive use in textiles conservation really comes into its own, that and really fragile textiles. So basically, I just applied, it's called casting, I just applied the adhesive, watered down 15% solution of the Lascar mix to this super wafty fabric and allowed it to dry on a really smooth surface. And that applies a very even layer of the adhesive once it's dried to the very fine textile, and then you can apply it on the sticky side down and reactivate it with heat because it's heat sensitive.
Oh, cool.
It's a very, very cool method, and it sort of solves quite a lot of problems. The idea, in fact, I'll say that later when I've talked about the other way I used the adhesive. The other way I used the adhesive was to apply it wet to the paint in a very, very low concentration. And that was a consolidation method because the paint itself was flaking actively, we'd call it. So it was very unstable. Quite a lot of it had been lost already. So we knew essentially without any intervention, it was going to just keep on going. So that was applying with a very fine brush to the edges of the paint and allowing the capillary action of the water-based emulsion to sort of scoot it underneath the paint flakes, essentially.
Amazing. Nice. Did you have to... It strikes me that if you're adding anything really to a very thin, fragile textile, that you're going to correct me if I'm wrong, I would imagine that it would affect the mechanical properties of that textile quite a lot. Firstly, is that the case? And if it is the case, then why prioritise, I don't know, what's your priority really, the appearance of it or the mechanical properties or something else?
So I love that you've brought that up because that is exactly one of the considerations. So the use of Lascar as an adhesive for film casting and for consolidation is that it has such a softness to it. And there are other adhesives that are used, and there are other adhesives particularly that are being tested for this sort of thing. But it sort of matches the softness to silk crepoline, really. It doesn't go stiff. It doesn't go sort of crinkly. It has the bend to it. And that's partly, I think, because of the mix of the two different molecular lengths, but also because of the fact that it is very, very stretchy. It's very sensitive to temperature. Again, with the mix that we use, we make sure it's not too sensitive to temperature because otherwise you'd have a really gooey object as soon as it reached 35 degrees. And right. Not that happens in the UK very often. I'd say that it really characterizes one of the main ways that we make decisions about the adhesives that we use. Obviously, before it comes into conservation, it has to be tested for its aging properties. And will it start going yellow in light? Will it start, you know, suddenly exuding acid for whatever reason? But it's the the sort of physicality of the textile, of the, excuse me, the physicality of the adhesive itself, how it responds. Will it be shiny on the surface of anything? Will it respond, I suppose, to changes in expansion or shrinkage during the life of the object? How strong is it? Will it break? I'm thinking about ceramics here. For a ceramic fix, we wouldn't use anything that was too strong necessarily, because then if it was put under strain in any way, the ceramic would go instead of the adhesive, and we'd want the adhesive to be the weak point rather than the ceramic. What else is there? I think there's so many considerations, but that's the sort of broad spectrum of them.
That is a really long list of considerations.
I know.
I wonder whether like chemical reactions, maybe, kind of like unexpected chemical reactions with the materials, maybe.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of an example to that, actually. Like what adhesive might there be that you wouldn't use for something specifically? I think it's the chemical reactions to the environment that are the things that we really consider, because if you've got a ceramic that's been totally fine for 200 years and then you put something next to it that's going to react with light or air and suddenly start becoming acidic and yellow, particularly if it then stops being soluble in what it was soluble before, then that's going to be a huge issue, and you've just given yourself a massive headache essentially. I've just mentioned reversibility really as a concept is a particularly important one in conservation as well, that nowadays we try and make sure that all the decisions we make are completely reversible. What we're doing is reacting to our knowledge now versus what happened in the past, so we know that attitudes will change, science will change, understandings of the object and the object's function will change, so, and also the materials will change. So what we don't want is to do something to an object that can't be reversed and then put ourselves in the position where we've essentially done damage to an object in 200 years when people suddenly say you shouldn't be doing this anymore.
That's so interesting. And I guess, yeah, we've been talking about kind of adding adhesives to stuff, but also I guess part of your work is being a bit of a forensic scientist as well and having a look to see what historical conservators have done, if there have been multiple fixes over time, and perhaps reversing some of their work, which perhaps wasn't originally designed to be reversible.
I think the concept of reversibility has been around for a long time, but in the very early days of conservation, so the 70s, I'm thinking early 80s maybe, it was more things were used slightly more, what should I say, in a slightly more gung-ho manner. Or there were particular sort of trains of thought that people would follow, and then that was proved with the passing of time to not be such a good idea for various reasons. And, you know, in particular adhesives that were used and then turned out to, in 30 years, have massive aging properties that made them really, really undesirable. Not that I can think of any examples. There are examples in ceramics and stone conservation in particular that the properties just essentially completely change.
Interesting.
So that's what we're trying to avoid.
Yeah. Yeah, I spent some time with a stone conservator. Would he call himself that? I'm going to have to check that. He's a stonemason anyway, but he does conservation works on buildings. And the Victorians apparently were really renowned for doing very aggressive conservation work and sticking cast iron into all sorts of different places to hold things together, and then 100 years later it rusts and everything falls apart.
Exactly that, yeah.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
No, it's the same thing with conservation nowadays, but the things that one would notice are much, much more subtle, I suppose.
I'm really surprised, actually, that you said that the early days of conservation was the 70s. I don't know. I guess I'm surprised to hear that that was the first time that we really were interested in conserving objects. Or is that not the case?
I think it isn't the case, but only because when I say the early days of conservation, that's more it became what it is now, really.
Ah, right.
It's changed, the attitudes towards museum objects changed quite dramatically. So people in the 50s were still fixing up old stuff, and they would sort of still be the caretakers of objects. But conservation as a discipline really now was, I'd say, birthed in the 70s.
Okay.
I hope other people, I think other people will agree with me there. I think so. But the other thing about reversibility that's really interesting to me, at least, and other geeky conservators, is the concept of whether it's actually possible or not. Because if you've impregnated an entire surface sort of that would have fallen to bits without it, can you wash that out? Can you use any, even if it is reversible, in a solvent, is there any way of getting that solvent in there enough and then out again in a way that isn't going to just take all of the object with it?
Right, so there are some processes that aren't really reversible, I guess.
Yeah, basically. I'm thinking anything to do with trying to get a consolidant out would be a nightmare. There's also arguments as if you're trying to remove the trace elements of what you've added,
right,
you're probably never going to do that, really.
Yeah, fair enough.
But the mechanicals, I'm just trying to think of what I would do if someone said, I need you to reverse this. I think in reality, unless you suddenly came up with a really yellow object because your adhesive had changed, your attitude would be to slowly try and reduce that yellowing, and you would be thinking more about trying to mitigate that damage, essentially, visually, because that's all that you'd be able to do. But then I'm talking about this as a conservator. Be very careful when I say that word.
Completely different meaning.
Completely different. I'm saying that as a conservator now, and in, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, they might have a totally different attitude and totally different science to back them.
Sure. Well, presumably they will, because that's how science works.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. Does being a conservator make you look at the world outside of museums differently?
I think yes, but I'm thinking of what example I would give you. I think a lot of the problem-solving elements that conservators find themselves doing, because obviously conservation is much, much more than just adhesives. It's also sort of logistics and, as I said, problem solving with how to, say, mount something or move something that's both very delicate and very heavy at the same time. In that respect, definitely. And just, well, it's hard for me to say, really, because I have a lot of old furniture because I like old things. So if there is, for example, a pest infestation in one of my chairs, I will have a very different attitude to sorting that out than maybe if I wasn't a conservator. Mm. I think having an understanding or an interest in particular or how things are put together is very much a conservation thing. And then that comes into the sort of artistic idea of the artistic and craft idea of how things are made, rather than just, you know, this is wood, which is layers of this and that. You see what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So then, yeah, I guess conservation work is at that. It's at the central point then between material science and art and making.
I like to think so. And I think it's partly because I'm an artist. I'm not really an artist, but I'm an artistic person. I do make things. And a lot of the conservators that I know are very practical people. And the science, I mean, you can come at it from two different angles, really, as it with anything. You can either come at it as an artist and train in the science, or come at it as a scientist and train in the art, really.
Mm. But I guess, like with your example of the very fine silk with the paint on top, like you do need to have the skills in art in order to be able to repaint things, to apply delicate materials to other materials. But with the knowledge of the art, I guess. Oh, sorry, with the knowledge of the science, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. It's using that understanding of what is available. And I think conservation is such a broad topic that there are conservators that are mainly material scientists, and they do the research and they do the analysis, and they do that basically. The two work hand in hand, basically. They can provide information to the people who are more on the sort of hands-on artistic side of things, and then the people, the hands-on artistic side of things, will provide the sort of the problems and the impetus and the sort of research goals for the material scientist. That's very broad. There's so many different types.
Yeah, of course. Which is what makes you such a perfect guest for this podcast, because it aims to sit between art and making the science of the materials. Have you ever had any real disasters with adhesives and conservation work? I was thinking, as I was writing these questions down, I had a thought about, do you remember that Mr. Bean sketch where he...
Oh, man.
Does everyone say yes. This to conservators? Yeah. Sorry
no,
if I'm huge.
But it's the thing that you sort of... I can't watch it. I cannot watch it. The Mr. Bean thing with the bubbling paint layers, can't do it.
Yeah, if any listeners can't remember or haven't seen it, it's Mr. Bean. There's some sort of like ancient beautiful portrait, and something happens to it. Oh, I'm telling this really badly. Something happens to it and he tries to wipe away a little smudge on the face of the...
He gets biro on it, I think.
Right.
And then he cleans off the biro using essentially paint thinner.
Yeah.
And actually, I haven't thought about it for so many years. I've not put any thought into what solvent that would be that would... The joke is essentially that he's removing it and then suddenly it starts reactivating the paint and all the paint is gone. So I don't know from a material scientist point of view, I'm not sure really what would be going on there.
Right. That actually wasn't going to be my question. That'd be putting you on the spot a bit. But my real question was, yeah, have you had any disasters in your work? Possibly not that disastrous, but have you ever stuck anything to anything else accidentally?
Hello, this is Anna from the future. Chloe did actually give me an answer to this question, but subsequently asked me to take it out, just in case her boss happens to listen to this episode. But Anna from the past wanted to keep the Mr. Bean bit in because she thought it was funny, so the question had to stay in, but Chloe's answer will be known only to us. Sorry about that.
Yeah, it strikes me that your work is all extremely, extremely subtle, and that actually
it is quite
like your aim is really to have your not your work not seen and not noticed, which is kind
yes.
of funny.
It is, though. There is this thing of if you have a really beautiful before and after photo, it's just
right.
Oh.
You can notice it because yeah, you've seen what you've done. Yeah,
exactly that. Yeah, yeah.
Nice.
So I think this is probably an interesting time to talk about my kind of personal and emotional attitude to adhesives, which is really, it's a strange thing to say, but I learnt all the material science in my degree. I have revised all the material science. I know and have tested the appropriateness of all the different adhesives that I use, particularly for all the different scenarios, but it's now been so many years and my memory is it's not bad, but it works differently to people who remember all the facts. My memory is such that I think I have more of a I feel the adhesives that I use rather than think them. So if people say to me, "What's that?" I go, I don't know. It's sort of not too brittle and it has really good properties in this respect and that respect. And if you were to, you know, solubilize it in acetone to half the amount, it works really good for this and that sort of thing. So that's, I think, what I mean when I say feeling it, that a lot of the time people and... With repeatability is as conservation as a science, it is favoured to have a favoured and genuinely very important to know what concentration you're using, not just the solvent that is carrying the adhesive, but also exactly what concentration, sometimes even what temperature, depending on what you're doing, which means essentially someone can read what you've written. If you publish it, or you can read what you've written if you're repeating it and get exactly the same results. That's, I suppose, a core aspect of conservation. However, when I'm working with some of these adhesives, so I'll name drop Paraloid B72, for example, and Klucel G and wheat starch paste. I use them and the solvent that I'm working with, so for example water for Klucel G and wheat starch paste or acetone for Paraloid B72, I use them in a more sort of intuitive way. So if I'm consolidating something, I might have one. I often work with watch glasses, for example, because you can have lots of different zones of what you're working with. I might add a bit more acetone to one area of the watch glass to impregnate an area of, for example, a cracking plaster. And then if it's a larger piece of cracking plaster that requires a bit more oomph, I might use an area of the watch glass that has less acetone. And if you were to ask me what the concentrations were that I was working with, or exactly why I'd chosen these things, I'd think, oh, hang on a minute, I just need to, you know, think about that and maybe just look it up quickly. And I don't think I'd be able to tell you what the concentration was. But that doesn't mean that the outcome wouldn't be positive. It just means, and it would have exactly the same sort of reversibility implications and visuals and all of that. But it's a kind of maybe a more artistic way of using the materials to hand that I don't want it to go. I want it to be runny in this instance, but not runny in that instance, if you see what I mean.
Totally. So being led by the materials that you actually find underhand rather than maybe the theories or, the exact concentrations.
Exactly, yeah. And I think we're very lucky in conservation that there are people who do have the funding and the knowledge and the time to research things so that we do know everything that we're using is... We know the appropriateness of everything we're using in different circumstances, basically. So we can be a bit more intuitive with our choices. But it's interesting because now how long have I been doing this? 7 years. I graduated 7 years ago. And obviously because of what I've learned and the experiences that I've had, my intuition has changed. So, for example, instead of using a Klucel G in some instances, which is a cellulose-based adhesive in water, often water or alcohol, I might choose a wheat starch paste instead, which is in water, because of the strength that it might have or because of other working properties. In that respect, it's not science. There's an element of conservation that isn't scientific at all, and I do know conservators that would probably frown on this attitude. Really, so am I nervous about saying it?
I think you're safe on this podcast. Don't worry. So I think adhesives is an area that I know a lot of listeners will have had some experience of. Even if it's just, you know, trying to super glue back together granny's favourite ceramic bowl that they've just smashed.
Oh, yeah.
So do you have a sort of key message to amateur, everyday conservators, you know, home conservators, for how to use adhesives?
I think the first thing I'd say is not meant to sound negative, but it can be construed as that, is a little information can sometimes be a very dangerous thing. If you're doing something that isn't reversible. So in that respect, I would know what you're using, and super glue is a really good one because you can just reduce it in acetone. But do have a look at whether the thing that you're sticking together can take acetone, because if you need to take it apart for any reason, like if you stuck the wrong bit to the wrong bit, particularly famous in ceramics because it's a jigsaw, then you need to know that you're not going to try and take it apart with acetone and then find that you can't, basically. Be careful with your quantities. That's a famous thing for people starting, is that they just use too much. But
and then it bulges out of the crack.
Yeah. Be careful, I think, is what I'd say. And practice. If you're interested in sticking stuff together, and you've got something that the cat pushed off the shelf, for example, it just happens to have been, you know, your mother's or grandmother's favorite vase or candle holder or whatever. If you've got a broken mug or something like something that you can just pick up from a charity shop that has no meaning to you, practice putting that together first, break it and practice putting that together first so you know what you're coming at with.
That's very good advice. Thanks for that.
If in doubt, contact a conservator. We love helping.
Nice. Well, that being said, how can people get in touch with you?
Well, me personally, I think I would contact the C Word podcast, because it also gives me a chance to say it again. Myself and my friend and colleague Jenny Mathiasen run a conservation podcast called The C Word, and we talk about all things in museums and conservation and heritage and that sort of thing. We can be contacted via that. I myself work, as I said, in the People's History Museum, and we can be contacted there. It's a museum of democracy, and we specialise in large painted textiles. Well, textiles in general, but painted textiles is our particular thing. And if you want to talk to any conservator, there will be one. We're all over social media, but there is often one that can be found in a museum, if you were interested in that, in talking to someone who had skills in a particular area of conservation. Local museums have fewer conservators, unfortunately, than the big nationals, but then the big nationals are always quite pressed for time.
Sure.
So just do some research. We do like to talk about our work, and we do like to get ourselves out there, so it's usually easy to find us.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been really, really great to chat to you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really nice.
So that was the amazing Chloe Rumsey talking all things conservation and adhesives. Thanks so much to her for taking the time to come on the podcast. That's everything for this week. As always, I'd be super grateful if you could take the time to like, subscribe, and tell all your friends about the Handmade podcast.
If you'd like to give a one-time donation, you can do so at supporter.acast.com/handmade. Every little that you can give helps to keep the podcast going. So thanks very much to those who have done that. If there's any material that you'd like to hear covered on the podcast, then you can always get in touch with us. We're at Real Talk on Twitter, that's R-I-A-L Talk, and on Instagram at Handmade Pod. If there's a hugely long materials rant that you would like to send us, we always welcome those too. You can do so via email at realtalkpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks as always to Dave Shepherd for our awesome cover art and to Alex Athbridge for the brilliant music mix. Thanks too to you for listening, and I'll see you next time on Handmade.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.